One of the most brilliant minds in the history of the human race belonged to a philosopher named Friedrich Nietzsche. It was Nietzsche's conviction that there is no such thing as God. In his classic work entitled Thus Spake Zarathustra, Nietzsche maintained that God was a concept invented by primitive and superstitious human beings who needed to invent some supernatural deity in order to make sense of the world. Much of modern science seems to agree with Nietzsche's conclusion. They say there is no reason behind the universe, no such thing as good and evil, no justice, no intention. The universe simply is, and that's the most we can say of it, although we can certainly examine it in great detail and learn about how it works. And life? Life is no mystery. It is simply the strife of selfish genes struggling for survival. Combine the thinking of Nietzsche with the conclusions of many modern scientists, and you arrive at the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre, who claimed there is no God and there is no morality. A human being is a useless passion, and life, well, life is an empty bubble on a sea of nothingness. Last week, I introduced you to John Polkinghorne, who is one of only a handful of people in the world regarded as both a world-class theologian and scientist. And we took a cursory look at how Polkinghorne, a theoretical physicist, is attempting to integrate the cutting-edge world of science with belief in God. Last week's sermon laid the foundation for what we will discuss today, what Polkinghorne calls the four aspects of belief in God, or what we could call the four reasons it's reasonable to believe in God. And I will preface this discussion once again with the idea of faith seeking understanding. Polkinghorne is not attempting to prove the existence of God. He does not believe that is possible. And as Kierkegaard pointed out, if we were able to prove God's existence, there would be no need for faith. And faith, along with hope and love, comprise the most important elements of human life. But still, what Polkinghorne does, I think, is very important, because beginning with the foundation of faith, he attempts to make sense of the world around us in light of the changes the world of science has forced upon our thinking over the past few centuries. In his world, in that little elite circle of theoretical physicists and mathematical geniuses who spend their days absorbed in the worlds of chaos theory and quantum mechanics, Polkinghorne often finds himself surrounded by atheists. It is encouraging and inspiring to find one of the scientific community's more elite colleagues standing firm on his faith and claiming that our belief in God is not based on primitive superstition, but rather on a heartfelt faith which is anchored on reason and truth. And so we move to the four reasons it is reasonable to believe in God. The first reason, the rational beauty of the universe. Polkinghorne writes, "There is much more to the mind of God than physics will ever disclose, but the rational beauty of the cosmos indeed reflects the mind that holds it together." The author makes a lot of great arguments about this, but I'm simply going to tell you what this means to me. The universe makes sense. All the stuff that makes up the universe fits together perfectly. And there's a certain beauty to the mathematical perfection of creation. Now, you may have heard this analogy before, but I think it's powerful enough to deserve another look. Let's pretend there's a beautiful gold pocket watch sitting there on the communion table, and you ask me how that watch came to be sitting there. What would you think if I told you the following story? I was sitting here in the sanctuary this morning, meditating right there in the first pew when the strangest thing happened. I heard a noise coming from behind me, and as I turned and looked back down the aisle, I saw a little spring bouncing up and down, slowly making its way down the aisle. And after a few minutes, that spring compressed itself, and with what looked like great effort, sprung itself right up there onto the communion table. I was somewhat shocked by this, but would you believe that just a few moments later, a gold base came floating out of the sky and landed right beside that spring? And then, perhaps even more remarkably, a bunch of tiny gears and sprockets just miraculously started appearing out of thin air, and they fell right into that gold base, after which the little spring jumped over into the base too. Well, similar amazing things continued to happen, with various and sundry parts appearing from here and there, the crystal, the winding knob, the hands. And after a couple of hours, as I sat right there in stunned disbelief, all those pieces arranged themselves into the pocket watch you see sitting there right now, which, by the way, according to my calculations, is keeping absolutely perfect time. Well, that's one story. But there is another way to answer your question about how that pocket watch came to be sitting on the communion table. And that story goes like this. Somebody made it, and it was placed there. Now, when you look at the rational beauty of that watch, at the way all the pieces fit together perfectly, at the way it performs the function for which it seems to have been made, at the way it appears to be the result of an intelligent mind who used an intelligent design to create it, when you look at the rational beauty of that watch, it makes sense to assume it did not create itself, and it has not always existed. It was made. Many of you will recall the movie Contact, based on the final book written by Carl Sagan. In that movie, Jodie Foster, a scientist who does not believe in God, mentions Occam's razor as one of the reasons for her disbelief. And while I thought that movie was absolutely wonderful, I was really disappointed with that particular part because it is a distortion of the way the concept of Occam's razor is normally used regarding the existence of God. William of Occam was a British philosopher who lived in the 14th century. It was his insight that the simplest answer to a question is usually the right answer. We call this principle Occam's razor. Cut away all the superfluous junk cluttering up any question, any idea, and take it down to its most basic form. And in this case, Occam's razor is used as a way of citing the logic for believing in God. Because when you cut away all the philosophical details and complicated arguments, the most logical and simple answer to the question, where did the universe come from, is found in the answer, it was created. Well, it's time to move beyond the first of the four reasons it is reasonable to believe in God, the rational beauty of the universe. The second reason is this, the world's finely tuned fruitfulness. This reason moves beyond the intelligence designed into the universe. Polkinghorne writes that any old world would not do. This reason for believing in God is based on the fact that you and I can be here today talking about these issues. When you look at the physical world, you see the process of entropy always at work. Things are always winding down, wearing out, using up their energy. But look at evolution. It is entropy in reverse. We have a universe that evolves, that grows, that produces systems of greater and greater complexity. The universe even got to the point where it could sustain life. And that life continued to evolve into more complex forms that became conscious. The universe is so fruitful, it seems to have been designed to literally burst forth with life that would eventually evolve into conscious life, capable of examining the world all around and actually feeling awe in the presence of the mystery that is calling it into being. And while there are those who honestly believe the matter we find in this universe haphazardly and accidentally arranged itself into this fruitful creation that brought forth thinking, logical creatures, Polkinghorne points out it is certainly reasonable to believe this is not all some big cosmic freak accident. It's the work of God. And so we have our first two reasons. It's reasonable to believe in God, the rational beauty of the universe, and the world's finely tuned fruitfulness. And those first two reasons are based primarily on science. With the next two reasons, we see more of the theologian coming out in Polkinghorne. Reason number three, the fact that we have a world that has values. We live in a moral world. We can envision a world that would not be moral, where there would be no such thing as right and wrong. But the world we have is a moral one. Now, frankly, many people will argue this fact. Polkinghorne first addresses the arguments that are usually used by people to prove we do not live in a moral world. Earthquakes, avalanches, cancers, hateful murders. All these things are used by some to prove that we live in a world free of moral value and that whatever it is we call morality is simply a legal code we place upon ourselves to ensure our survival. But Polkinghorne has some great insights. He says that all those things we consider evil are, quote, the necessary cost of a creation given by its creator the freedom to be itself. And he adds, a world allowed to make itself is better than the puppet theater of some cosmic tyrant. There's another recently released book that is making a bit of a splash called Finding Darwin's God by Kenneth R. Miller. Miller is very critical of those atheists in the scientific community who, quote, routinely enlist the material findings of evolutionary biology in support of their own personal philosophical pronouncements. Miller's argument is basically the same one that Polkinghorne uses. God designed the universe to create itself, and evolution is a part of that design. But getting back to Polkinghorne, it's important to understand that the freedom designed into this world is grounded on morality. Again, I'll let Polkinghorne speak for himself. I believe that it is of the highest significance that we live in a moral world, that we have moral knowledge which tells us that love and truth are better than hatred and lies. Again, there can be no argument about it. Hatred, lies, and tragedy exist in this world. But what matters, what tells us that God is still here in spite of all those things, is the fact that we know, we can tell, we are instinctively aware of the difference between right and wrong, good and bad, hate and love. There is a supreme source of love and truth that is reflected in everything. This reminds me of Immanuel Kant, who said there were two things that filled him with ever-increasing wonder and awe, the starry heavens above and that moral law within. And what Polkinghorne is asking us to do is imagine a world without that moral law that resides within us. Was such a world possible? Is it possible to imagine such a world? Yes. Do we have such a world? No. And that is the third reason that it is reasonable to believe in God. We live in a world that has values. And so we come to Polkinghorne's fourth reason, which again is based more on theology than science: human hope. When we look at the universe, it appears that this is a one-time occurrence, beginning with the Big Bang, that will eventually, through entropy, burn itself out. And when we look at human life, it appears that each human life is a one-time occurrence that begins with birth and ends with death. But there is something inside of us that looks those apparent facts squarely in the eye and says, no, that's not all there is. And Polkinghorne says that there is one who is the ground of all hope, God, who lives within us and demands that we say no to any hint of futility when it comes to the world itself and when it comes to human life. I'm not going to try to recreate Polkinghorne's argument for life beyond death. It's complex, and I don't really understand it all. He uses this combination of logic, the Bible, and the philosophy of Aristotle to make a logical argument that it is perfectly reasonable to believe God will indeed resurrect us after we die. And please, this is not to be confused with resuscitation of the bodies we leave behind, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. But the spiritual reality, which is a human being, according to Polkinghorne, exists within the mind of God and is not bound by the restraints of the physical world. At the end of his argument, he writes, "If the world is really intelligible through and through, then this life by itself is not the whole story." Human hope. It's a part of who and what we are, and thus Polkinghorne concludes his four reasons it is reasonable to believe in God in an age of science. To recap the four reasons: the world has a rational beauty that would not have happened by chance. The world is fruitful, and contrary to the normal laws of physics, it grows more and more fruitful. The world is moral, filled with human beings who have the truth about the difference between right and wrong written across the very core of their being. And even in the face of helplessness, we are anchored on the gift of human hope, which along with faith and love gives meaning and purpose to our lives. Well, I know that these past two sermons have been a bit demanding. I believe this ongoing and developing relationship between science and faith is very important and very interesting, but I certainly realize it is not a simple subject. And I know this is undoubtedly one of the few congregations to be found anywhere where a minister could even dare to attempt to discuss John Polkinghorne. And for the privilege of standing in this pulpit, I am thankful beyond words. And I do hope all of this has been of some benefit, because as we seek to anchor our lives on the principle of faith seeking understanding, it's nice to have intelligent friends like Polkinghorne who assure us that our faith is reasonable. When I started studying Polkinghorne, I found it tedious at first, but after some time, I found the effort very much worthwhile. We live in a world where many of our best and brightest have dismissed God. They have collectively embraced the thinking of Friedrich Nietzsche, who said that humanity has outgrown its need for God, that God was a necessary illusion for us to maintain for a period of our history, but it is now time to grow up and leave behind primitive superstition. Nietzsche was a brilliant, brilliant man. He died, by the way, an old man, and by the time of his death, he was insane, living for a time in an asylum where he was diagnosed as having paranoid delusions of grandeur and persecution. He spent his final years beneath the curse of a psychotic delusion. He had created for himself a world that had no place for God. As a society, Here in the early part of the 21st century, we have pushed God to the outer margins of our world. I shudder to think what will happen to the human race if we allow a self-proclaimed elite on the cutting edge of philosophy and science to convince the rest of us that God has no place in our world, because God will still be here. But we, as a species, will have placed ourselves under a psychotic delusion. Like a child who plays under the midday sun but closes his eyes and claims there is no light, we will have blinded ourselves to the simple truth that the world is beautiful only if we see its beauty. And the world is miraculously fruitful only if we acknowledge the miracle of our own existence. And the world is moral and just only if we anchor our lives on truth and justice. And human life is grounded on hope only if we embrace that hope and use our lives to call that hope into being through our love. So I thank God for John Polkinghorne. In a world where so many of our best and brightest cannot see the beauty because they are looking so intently for the truth, he has looked directly into the eyes of the truth and is telling us that the truth itself is very, very beautiful. Amen.